Welcome to the MLB Trade Rumors Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the MLB Trade Rumors Podcast. My name is Dara McDonald, and I am deferring most of my salary to the 2034 to 2043 period. There is so much to talk about. Last week, we were talking about how the baseball offseason is sort of like an old train, and it was just starting to churn and pull out of the station, but it has picked up a lot of steam since last week. So let's talk about it. With me to talk about it is MLB Trade Rumors founder Tim Durkas. How's it going, Tim?
Hey, it's going good, Dara. And also, I want to say I'm happy to hear that you're going to defer 97% of your salary. That'll give me a lot of flexibility to add more baseball writers. So thank you.
Okay, so there's so much Ohtani stuff to talk about. Ohtani is obviously an incredibly unique player, and then he had an incredibly unique free agency, and now he has signed an incredibly unique contract. So, Tim, I know you have thoughts because you cracked your knuckles last night and you got in front of the keyboard and wrote an article about Ohtani. So let's share your thoughts in podcast form.
Yeah, sure. It was kind of like that one meme where the guy's like, hang on, honey, someone's wrong on the internet. And so, like, you know, at first I was on Twitter and I was kind of like, I don't know if I mentioned on this show that I have the For You feed on Twitter, on my own personal Twitter. So it just serves me up like Tim Durkas catnip. And then, like, I want to respond to it. And then it sees that I responded to it, and it gives me a bunch more. So it gave me a lot of, you know, fans that a lot of Padres fans like are in my timeline for some reason. And it gave me a lot of fans that, just with the Ohtani deal, when the contract structure came out yesterday, that are, you know, really mad about it. And I'm not trying to police people's emotions about it. And I think we can talk about what's good for the game and stuff a little bit later in this show. The point I was trying to make in the article I published last night, which was really just like, I had to get this off my chest because this is what I feel about this, is that this was not an example of the Dodgers getting around the competitive balance tax, because they're taxed at $46 million as Ohtani's average annual value. And I think that we found $46 million to be eminently reasonable, predictable, and just what we thought he would get. And so maybe he could have gotten like 50 somewhere. But, you know, we did not ever think he would or could get 70. We don't have any evidence that somebody offered him a $70 million annual salary, non-deferred. So 70 is kind of the shiny number. Tom Verducci of Sports Illustrated had an article where he quoted an executive saying that, you know, the total of this contract is a shiny object, and you got to look at how you get to it. And so, you know, if MLB is computing the present value of this contract, you know, with their own kind of formulation, and they're coming at $460 million over 10 years, that's the number that matters more. But once the 700 and the 70 get ingrained in the media, it's kind of hard to get away from them. So if he would have just signed a 10-year, $460 million deal, a lot of drama and hand-wringing would have been avoided.
Okay, so who benefits from it being portrayed as $700 million as opposed to $460 million?
Possibly primarily his agent, Nez Bolelo. I mean, agents love getting contract records. And, you know, Scott Boras has done contracts with a lot of deferred money. And, you know, the total is kind of the scorekeeping thing. So the agency looks good. The agent looks good. The player, you know what? Based on what I've read, if it is kind of representative of what baseball fans think, he does not benefit from people thinking he's actually getting $700 million because that number is so far beyond expectations. And it's also not real, but people don't realize it's not real. And it makes him into a villain. I think Ohtani was going to be some level of a villain, you know, in most scenarios where he signed somewhere else. But I think it's a little easier with the Dodgers. And then I think it's a little easier where they created a legal contract structure that definitely offers them a large advantage. One point that I kind of want to underline is that while I don't think that they got a luxury tax advantage, they obviously got a huge advantage on their actual payroll of how much they are paying the player for the next 10 years. They're paying him $2 million. That's laughably absurd, ludicrous, all the adjectives you want to come up with. It is nuts. We've never seen it. It's allowed, and
that's
it will
Garrett
allow
Hampson
them.
Money.
But so yeah, it's I was saying it's less than Austin Barnes is going to make. Yeah. You know, the people are going to be talking for the next decade about all the people who make more money than Shohei Ohtani. And, you know, this just occurred to me, like, what happens if the major league minimum salary in the next 10 years actually goes past $2 million? I don't think it will. But anyway, like, that's a major talking point. And I get it. And I do understand the frustration, because it is an accounting trick that gives the Dodgers kind of a bunch of cash flow that they kind of wouldn't normally have to go out and add more players. But, you know, anybody can do it if they find a willing player to do it. So the Dodgers, I've seen in our comments section, there's actually some good comments there on that post I wrote, and people describe it as a perfect storm. You know, you had the right team, you had the right player. Most players don't want to be paid 97% of their contract 10 years later, 10 to 20 years later.
Right. So maybe we should talk about why Ohtani would agree to something like this. So from Ohtani's perspective, you know, just first of all, from a basic like accounting point of view, a dollar is worth more now than it will be 20 years from now. So it's actually sort of harmful to him in a sense to be paid more later than to be paid now. But he's willing to do it supposedly because he's making so much in endorsements right now that the low salary doesn't really matter to him. I've seen like 45 or 50 million suggested as how much he's making annually just from endorsements and other like non-baseball revenue sources. So he doesn't need the money right now. And then also, if he wants to win, this helps the team put a winning team around him. Like you said, they'd have more money for Yamamoto or whoever else they try to sign now. So like you said, the perfect storm thing, he is willing to do it because of his unique financial situation and his desire to win.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And it's the opposite of greedy. So I don't, you know, to make that guy into a villain for that, it's just nonsensical to me. And I know that like the word fan comes from fanatical and stuff. And like, if you were just a fan of a team, you know, that is a Dodgers rival, you're just going to be mad about this. But I mean, I don't think it's greedy for him to do this at all. It's the opposite. And it's kind of like he's taking on a bunch of risk that I think that, you know, his agents or the players union would probably be like, maybe you shouldn't do that. And he was like, I assume he was like, yeah, well, I want to. And, you know, here are the reasons I think it can increase my chances of getting some rings. So I think that Ohtani is kind of, and this is probably better for like a finance person to get into, but he's taking on risk that most players don't want. He's kind of betting on the United States economy and, you know, betting on the future of the Dodgers and things like that, that, you know, most players don't do.
Right. So I guess the biggest potential downside here is for the Dodgers as well. Maybe you would disagree. I don't know, but they have far more financial flexibility now in the next 10 years. But at some point, next decade, they're going to be paying $70 million to a player who's not on the team anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I still think it's advantageous to them, though.
Sure. You know? But they are kicking the cost down the line, so, right?
Yeah, true. But I also think, like, you know, they're kind of counting on some of the revenue from this player kind of funding his own salary later.
Sure.
Possibly, you know, the added benefit of going to or winning some World Series would be part of that. So I think the team will be fine.
Oh yeah, no, I'm not worried. I'm not worried about the Dodgers. So crazy contract. What else? Do we want to talk about the crazy lead up to the contract? Like, it was a pretty. We talked last week about, you and I had a long debate about Ohtani's privacy and how his free agency was sort of shaping up to not be that exciting. But that kind of got flipped on its head a little bit in the past week. Maybe have your feelings on that changed?
It was kind of naive, I guess, of me to think that this contract would get done without some drama. But I will say this. Some of the drama was just caused by two reporters who made mistakes. Some other drama was caused by, you know, people trusting an opera singer and doing flight tracking and stuff. And then some of the drama was caused by the unique contract structure. Back to the Friday media thing. We've been doing this for 18 years. I've seen reporters of all different caliber, and I've seen good reporters have misses because they got bad information. And so, you know, I think it's best to try to handle those reports with grace. I heard John Morosi on air, you know, do an apology, and, you know, it was very classy. It was professional, and he took full ownership. And, you know, I've only met John a couple of times, but he does seem to, you know, back up his really strong reputation around the game just as like a great guy and a beloved reporter. And so I don't know. I mean, I just like to kind of not rag on these guys. And I know JP Hornstra had a thing that proved incorrect, and it's a shame. You know, it's not what those guys want, and I think that they're regretful for it. But it's going to happen sometimes. There's a really good article. We should probably like link to it somewhere in the comments by Bob Nightingale that he wrote on Sunday that laid bare what it means to be a scoop guy in terms that I really had not seen before. He talked about where the information comes from. He said it was more than 95% agents. He talked about how reporters, himself included, let agents basically dictate things that he tweets. I think that implies or translates to agents to some degree dictating what goes into their articles. So there was some really interesting stuff from him. I'd recommend you read it. And I think a bigger philosophical question could be, are scoop guys journalists? And I mean, that's thorny. And I'm not sure I'm qualified to answer it because I'm kind of on the sidelines. So it would be interesting to poll, you know, Ken Rosenthal and Jeff Passan and those guys about that type of thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and we should say, I guess, you know, this isn't the first time that erroneous information has come out, you know, like you allude to. I think we had the arson judge thing last year where Heyman said he was going to the Giants and then he was going to the Yankees. So it does happen, especially seemingly with the most frenzied, most popular free agents, that information gets chaotic.
Yeah, these guys are rushing. They're not being subject to any kind of editorial process when they're tweeting, and mistakes are made. And then I think, like, from what I understand of like regular journalism, anonymous sources are kind of a last resort. You know, like you use it if there's a really strong reason to not identify the person, and if the person won't go on the record, you might not use it. But baseball reporting is like almost all anonymous sources. So, you know, every report we see, you know, most reports we see then are leaked by agents, as per Bob Nightingale. And then usually, almost always, there's some motivation behind why that agent leaked that information. So if he gave a scoop to a reporter, he did that for a reason, to get some benefit in the future. If he put out something about his, you know, own client, the level of interest, of course, he did that to help drum up the market. So we're seeing a lot of agenda-based information, and it's the trade-off that we make to get these nuggets and rumors before the official announcement. I mean, we could have a version of MLB Trade Rumors that was just team press releases about deals that were done. And maybe, you know, some teams even report the terms of the contract right into the press release. We could have that, and it would be more accurate, obviously, but it would be less fun. So we make a trade-off. You know, we're going to have some entertainment from the hot stove, and we're going to hear some things about Ohtani before the Dodgers do a press release. And unfortunately, some small percentage of that information is going to be wrong.
Okay, well, we also
Wait, you know what? I just had one more note I wanted to mention, is that I haven't had like tons and tons of conversations with general managers of teams. However, a few years ago, I did talk to David Stearns when he was Brewers GM, and I asked him what percentage of information that gets out to the media is correct. And he said roughly half. And I found it really interesting. Obviously, he would know. And so a lot of the stuff we put out there, and then we put, you know, at MLB Trade Rumors, we put that stuff out there with the best of intentions. You know, when we put JP Hornstra's thing up there, it's because we thought it was true. And so when there are things that we actually think are not true, we don't put them up. So, but I thought it was interesting to have an actual GM kind of say, like, look, a lot of this is just wrong.
And isn't that, so as per the collective bargaining agreement, like a general manager can't say we are not interested in a certain player, or like this player is not worth X amount of money or whatever. So if an agent hypothetically leaks a thing to a reporter, let's randomly say like, you know, the Royals are interested in Seth Lugo or something like that. The Royals can't come out and say, no, we are not interested in Seth Lugo. And so that gives the agency side some free rein to try to like manipulate or like affect the market in some way, knowing that they can't really get pushback.
Yeah, this was a big point that Bob Nightingale made, that you know, the team just doesn't have the recourse against bad information. And so I think the most, you know, the team could do would be to call up a bunch of its writers and leak that they're not interested in that player. But then they're taking on some level of risk. So they might rather just, okay, fine, Seth Lugo's market might be a little inflated because my interest was overstated. Oh, well.
All right. Well, we also have a mega trade for Juan Soto, which is item number two on our podcast. Do you want to, is there any other part of the Ohtani craziness that we haven't covered, do you think?
Yeah, one thing that I think comes up with the fans a lot is, especially when they saw this contract structure, which is kind of like giving a team that already has, you know, a huge payroll advantage, another advantage because they were able to kind of exploit it. It's that this idea that this contract, especially under the structure for Ohtani, is not good for baseball. That might be so. But, you know, I kind of want to talk about the whole good for baseball concept, because I think it's just not a real thing. I think that you have 30 owners of 30 corporations, and then you have however many players, you know, 776 or whatever you want to call it. And when they get to the collective bargaining table, there's not like a third group that's just kind of looking out for the good of the game in some kind of vague, like purist sense. It's more like the players are trying to get as much of this revenue pie as they can, and the owners are trying to get as much for themselves. And if the collective bargaining agreement that they come to isn't good for certain teams, or isn't good for certain fans, or isn't good for like the enjoyability or competitive balance or parity of baseball, so be it. There's not an entity in there that fights for that mythical thing. So baseball by its nature does not have competitive balance. I mean, yes, teams with lower payrolls can reach the World Series and compete and stuff, but it's obviously harder. And they don't have competitive balance because it's just baked into the design of having a team in Los Angeles and having another team in Milwaukee. Those, you know, those teams have different revenues. So you could try to fix it, but usually fixing it involves transference of money between owners or between players and ownership that make people mad and cause lockouts and strikes. So if what you care about is the good of baseball in terms of like people hitting balls with sticks and catching those balls with gloves, like go coach a youth team or something, or go play with your buddies or something. And like, I actually have done those things. I do them all the time and it's super fun. And I coached my 10-year-old recently in fall baseball, and his team was called the Orioles, and we chose it because the orange was cool. And on the first day, I'm like, who's everybody's favorite Orioles player? Not a single kid out of 13 could name a single Orioles player. And some of them probably couldn't name any baseball players outside of like, you know, Cubs or White Sox players. So I think that those kids were interested enough to want to be on this youth baseball team and commit their time to it. And they seem to enjoy being on the field and playing, but they aren't really fans of Major League Baseball. And so, I mean, you can talk about the good of the game, but the game can be strong independent of Major League Baseball.
Yeah, well, I think baseball is pretty unique in that respect. Since it's every day, you can be a huge fan and only pay attention to your one team, unlike some other sports, you know, where, you know, football's once a week. So people like pay attention to their team, but also like the league as a whole. Baseball is so time consuming just to pay attention to one team that you can ignore the other 29. But yeah, just to quickly, I mean, the parity thing, these things, they sometimes come up between owners. I mean, I don't know if we have the time to get deep into it on this podcast, but, you know, there's obviously the big owners like the Yankees and Dodgers, which don't really care about competitive balance. But then a team like the Brewers or the Rays or whatever will. So that's how things like extra draft picks and the qualifying offer and things like that do get into the CBA. So there is like, that's really the only push towards competitive balance is the smaller market teams saying, you know, this is in our interest and the interest of the league, presumably, to, you know, it wouldn't be very interesting if the Dodgers and Yankees won all the time.
Yeah, I mean, and it's by its nature unfair. And so that's why we have revenue sharing. And I think in the last CBA talks, you know, the players kind of tried to dictate or influence how revenue is shared. And the owners are kind of like, well, you know, we want to fight amongst ourselves about this. But that's like, that's a major mechanism for trying to transfer some of the Dodgers' wealth to the Brewers. But it's never, they're never going to be even. I do think with the kind of resettling of the way the TV deals are, that at some point when some of the contracts expire or are defaulted on or something, and possibly all television revenue gets centralized, then we could see some increased parity.
Yeah, that's something the owners are going to fight about in the years to come.
Oh, yeah.
More people stream baseball instead of watching it on TV. So it's who gets that money. Is it the Dodgers and the Yankees, or the smaller market teams get a bigger share than they theoretically deserve, et cetera, et cetera.
They have so many things to fight about. And people have said, oh, man, this Ohtani thing, deferrals are going to be a huge issue in the next CBA. And I'm like, I don't know, man, unless like all these players start deferring tons of money. And the result is that all the big market teams have $2 million superstars, and this becomes like a regular thing because players are like suddenly cool with getting paid way later. I don't see it as like a major, major issue. I think it could be addressed, but I don't know that MLB will trade something of value to the players union for the players to kind of give it up.
Yeah, I guess it's sort of like the qualifying offer in that it affects such a small number of players. Yeah. Like, you know, there's obviously some, there's always somebody who's like, they need to get rid of the qualifying offer, but it only affects like 7 or 8 guys a year. And then even the ones who get it, like Ohtani, it doesn't matter to him because that's just like an accounting thing.
Agreed.
Okay. So beneath all of this, buried in the headlines somehow, a superstar caliber player, Juan Soto, has now twice been traded before his 26th birthday. The Yankees got Juan Soto and Trent Grisham for 5 players, and a lot of money really is at play here as well. How do you feel about this deal, Tim?
I mean, if you're a Yankees fan, you just have to love it. They gave up some decent stuff, you know, I guess led by Michael King and Drew Thorpe, but they didn't kind of give up, you know, the absolute top prospects in the game or players, you know, who had immense value. They just kind of gave up some good rotation pieces. I mean, King only has 2 years of control remaining. And so the price is reflective of Soto having a high salary and being a 1-year rental. But if you're the Yankees, you have to love having 2 of the 10 best or even 5 best hitters in baseball in your lineup. You have to love the balance. And, you know, the main question with the Yankees, I think, remains health. You got like 4 key players in the lineup who are age 32 and up. So keeping them healthy is key, because then you got to go down to, you know, your depth pieces into the lineup and run some ugly lineups out there if guys get hurt again. But I mean, the other factor with the Soto trade is the Yankees competitive balance tax payroll, which I think is around $290 million, and they're a third time payer. So everything that they spend over $297 million will be taxed at a rate of 110%. And the Yankees pretty obviously need pitching. So, you know, if they were to go out and sign Jordan Montgomery for $25 million, he would cost them more than 50 in 2024. So I do think that they're going to plow through that the way that the Mets have and teams occasionally will do. But I mean, when they sign a player and you have to double his salary, it's still worth thinking about. Like, if they want to go get Jordan Hicks and he wants $12 million a year and now it's 24, it gives you some pause.
Yeah. Now, Steve, was it Steve Adams? I don't know if he did it in a front office piece or if he was just like texting us, but he was talking about, you know, sometimes people ask him what a star player would get if they only signed 1 year deals. Did he do a front office piece on this? Am I remembering this correctly? Or did
I think he might have been texting us? Yeah, I'm not sure.
But it's an interesting experiment here because Soto, he hasn't yet set his salary for 2024, but we have projected $33 million. And like you said, with the taxes, it's probably going to be over $60 million that they're actually paying him. And they were willing to give up five different players to get him. So that would imply that if he was a free agent and was willing to sign a 1 year deal, the Yankees or somebody would be willing to pay him more than $60 million for that 1 year of his services.
Yeah, it absolutely does imply that. And I think that just because we're rooting for interesting things at MLB Trade Rumors, or at least I am, we're always kind of waiting for that superstar player to come along at the peak of his abilities and be like, hey, I want a 1 year deal, straight 1 year. Let's see what we can do. And I'm willing to sign with any team. And I'm not kidding. I'm really a mercenary and I want to sign a 1 year deal. Trevor Bauer gave a lot of lip service to that idea, but he instead chose to lock in, you know, 3 years worth of money. And so we still haven't seen a player kind of maximize both his risk and reward. So it hasn't really been tested. But yeah, I mean, you know, the top average annual value, you might say, is Ohtani's 46. And so all we really saw there was kind of a small 6% movement from the 43 and a third that we'd seen with the short-term contracts of Verlander and Scherzer to the 46. You know, we have Judge at 40. So we've kind of set this range in the 40s, but these guys are either superstars getting really long contracts or they're, you know, aging ace type pitchers getting 3 year contracts. And so we still don't know what kind of a star in his prime would get on a 1 year deal.
Okay, but accounting aside, the Yankees, like you mentioned, they have a fearsome lineup punch there. Soto and Judge, that's going to be tough for opposing pitchers, even though it's going to cost the Yankees a pretty penny. The Padres, they gave up a lot to get Soto, and they're getting kind of a lot in terms of just volume. They got five players for Soto now. How do you feel about where the Padres are, though, without Soto going into 2024?
It's a big hit. He's not a guy that you can replace. They did find multiple cheap rotation candidates. How many innings they can get out of those guys, I don't know. I think that with the Padres, you do look back on some of the things that they did previously that tied them up. And the number one that I think everybody thought was kind of shocking at the time was the Xander Bogaerts contract. They did not need a shortstop. They had multiple options at shortstop. There were and continue to be questions about Bogaerts, you know, as a long-term shortstop. And they gave him an 11-year, $280 million deal. And it didn't seem necessary. And you look at that and you're like, well, if nothing else, if they hadn't done that, they probably would have kept Soto this year and taken one last run with Soto. And, you know, issued him a qualifying offer after, or if they tanked in the middle of the season, traded him for some parts that probably would be a bit less than the Yankees sent them, but possibly not that different. So it's kind of a shame that his salary and some of the other players that they purchased, you know, the Cronenworth contract is looking pretty bad right now, too. I think it's just about to start. That those factors kind of converged and they had to give up a superstar.
Yeah, they were just so pedal to the metal the past few years. The Padres, they gave out, like you mentioned, Bogarts and Cronenworth, and like Yu Darvish and Manny Machado got big extensions. And so suddenly there was all this money, and then now, you know, they had to cut it back because of their, you know, the league was concerned about their debt levels. And so they had to cut something. And so Soto was sort of expendable because of the fact that he hasn't signed an extension. So now, do you think, tying together the two things that we talked about here, I think we talked about it last week or maybe the week before about Soto's theoretical next deal. Do you think that the Ohtani signing does anything for Soto's market next winter?
Yeah, I think it's kind of a factor. I think, you know, the 460 number that MLB is kind of using as the proxy for the luxury tax on Ohtani, I think probably if I was the Boris Corporation, I would at least be expecting and looking to top that. So if Soto goes ahead and does a deal with no deferrals, you know, you'd be aiming for $500 million. And I think this kind of reinforces that. But it also does not, you know, suggest that there's $550 or $600 million out there for Juan Soto either. You know, Ohtani, ultimately, in terms of kind of the present value, did not get a shocking contract. And so it just moved the salary scale forward in somewhat of a normal, manageable way. And then I think we're going to see more of this as Soto's free agency gets closer. But there's definitely questions about what he is and is going to be beyond a bat. You know, he's this guy who should be slotted in at left field. His defense is a negative. He's not particularly fast. And so he's not this multidimensional player. And even if you look at like Bryce Harper, I think at the time of that signing, he was at least regarded as a strong right field defender. I'm a little surprised at kind of how easily the Phillies were willing to move Harper like way down the defensive spectrum, but they seem happy. So, you know, who am I to judge? But yeah, I think with Soto, there's going to be teams that are like, wow, okay, this really might be a Ted Williams level hitter, but you know, there's two sides to his game. And if he's a negative on defense, we are going to factor that in. I think Soto is still a high war guy, even when that is factored in. So, and he's also incredibly young for a free agent. So he is going to get a huge contract.
All right. Well, there's lots of other stuff going on, but I think we should probably wrap it there. Thank you so much for coming on the show again, Tim.
Yeah, my pleasure.
So the offseason is starting to pick up steam, like I said, Ohtani and Soto, but there's still so many more free agents out there. Yamamoto is meeting with clubs, possibly as you are listening to this, and Snell is still out there, and Montgomery is still out there, and Matt Chapman's still out there, and Cody Bellinger is still out there, and there's probably going to be a trade of, who knows, Tyler Glasnow, Dylan Cease. So go to MLBTradeRumors.com and follow all that action and sign up for the front office package to get extra stuff and get rid of the ads. And we will be back with more analysis next week.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. Remember to visit MLBTradeRumors.com and follow us on Twitter at MLBTradeRumors.